Hello everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Richard Cowardine about his study of the role of humor in the life of America's 16th president, entitled Lincoln's Sense of Humor. Richard, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. I'm very grateful for the invitation.
I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
I'm now a retired historian from Oxford University. I was the Rhodes Professor of American History for 7 years. I then retired from that to become president of one of the 38 self-governing colleges that make up Oxford University, Corpus Christi College. I saw the college into its 500th anniversary year, 2017, and I'm now happily semi-retired and returning to the life of the writing scholar. So that's it in a nutshell.
What was it that led you to write this book?
As with so many explanations for why one does things, it's partly to do with other people's initiatives. I gave a lecture on Lincoln's humor many years ago at a conference in the Huntington Library in California, 2009. Gary Gallagher, Joan Waugh invited me to speak at one of their Civil War conferences, and I thought, well, I'd like to do a talk on Lincoln and the Copperheads and his view of the Copperheads, and his, in particular, the way in which he'd warmed to a satire at the expense of Copperheads written by David Ross Locke. The protagonist in this satire is the figure of Petroleum V. Naseby, and we may have occasion to talk about him later on. But that led me into really examining a satirical work that Lincoln found extremely attractive, extremely funny, and wonderfully edgy in the way in which it exposed the ethical flaws, as he would see them, of Copperheadism. It was a single lecture. I gave the lecture in the Huntington Library, and the following year I was invited to Gettysburg to give the lecture again, and the editor of the Concise Lincoln Library, Sylvia Rodrigue, was present, and following that, a couple of years later, in fact, not immediately, but eventually, she got in touch and said she thought that Lincoln's sense of humor would make a very good subject for the Concise Lincoln Library series. Would I be interested in writing for it? And at the time I was president of Corpus Christi College, I didn't have a lot of time for a major scholarship, but I thought I could probably, in the corners of time, little pockets of time that you get as a president of an institution, work on the subject. And Sylvia, my editor, was generous in giving me latitude of time to complete it. And eventually in 2016, I submitted my manuscript and the book came out just a couple of months ago. So that's really the story. It was an initiative taken by an editor in response to a lecture that I'd enjoyed researching, and which took me into an aspect of Lincoln that I'd long thought worthy of exploration, but had never previously found the time to do.
One of the aspects of the topic that I found so interesting is how it really runs counter to the image of Lincoln that so many people have in their mind, sort of the image of Lincoln at the memorial of the stern, kind, yet very serious statesman. And as you explain, that is, in some respects, a misnomer, and that humor played a very large role in both Lincoln's life and his career.
Yes, I think that it's very easy to take Lincoln's reputation as a storyteller, to take that without the full seriousness that it deserves. I do think that you get a better way of understanding someone from what makes them laugh as from what makes them serious. I think it's a way of getting a purchase on Lincoln that has been certainly revelatory to me. I think it takes us, his humor takes us to the heart of the man. As I say, I think we learn as much, if not more, about people when they're being funny as when they're being serious. His humor was really a sort of reflex, a habit of mind, as one of his colleagues put it. It was rich, many-sided. He had a Catholic taste in humor, and tall tales, Western tall tales, political satire, as I've mentioned, sharp wit, absurdity, morality tales, particularly bawdy jokes. He read widely in terms of humorous literature. He was also a very fine mimic. He could reduce an audience to tears of laughter. He appreciated the absurd. I think his appreciation of absurdity gave him a sense of proportion, a sense of the follies of humankind. I would even go so far as to say that a sense of humor is possibly an essential element in statesmanship, in the highest form of statesmanship, because I think it provides a sense of a proportion of human folly, human frailty. So yes, it is very much a feature of Lincoln. I think it's to be seen in conjunction with something that we've known about Lincoln, what is more commonly understood about Lincoln, which is that he was a man who suffered very considerably from melancholy and from sadness and times, indeed, acute depression. Those bouts of deep depression are very well documented. Billy Herndon, his law partner, said, you know, Lincoln was a sad-looking man. He said melancholy dripped from him as he moved. And I think we have to see his laughter, his humor, as the other side of that coin. And another colleague, David Davis, Judge David Davis, said that Lincoln's jokes were done to whistle off sadness, And I think there was an element of deliberation in Lincoln's turning to humor as a means of contending with those periods of depression. There's a similarity here, I think, with our great British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, who also suffered from these visits of what he called the black dog. And when Lincoln was entertaining Francis Carpenter, the portrait painter, in the White House for about 6 months, he opened the doors of the White House for Carpenter to work on his great portrait of the Emancipation Proclamation, the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation. And Carpenter quotes Lincoln saying, and it sounds to me entirely authentic, he said that, you know, if it weren't for the jokes and the jests, the stories that he told, Lincoln said he would not have a means of dealing with his moods and his gloom. He said that these jokes were the vents of my moods and gloom. So, yeah, I think humor is absolutely at the core of Lincoln's being. It's not the only element at the core of his being, but without it, he said, if we don't understand that, we don't understand what it was that made him tick. I don't mean by saying this, by the way, that Lincoln didn't, as it were, cultivate his humorous craft. I mean, it was natural to him. It was instinctive. But he was also actually extremely enterprising in the way in which he was almost as enterprising in his use of humor as he was in politics. And he used that humor in a variety of different ways. It wasn't just as therapy, but it was also to outwit his political opponents. It was to outwit his legal adversaries. It was also a means, he told his tales very often as a means of illustrating a political or a legal point. So there was a kind of utilitarian dimension to it in that way. He would use a story as a way of making a point forcefully or making a point clearly to a jury or to an audience of ordinary folk. And he also used it deliberately, I think, as a means of self-deprecation. It was a way of emphasizing his common roots, the fact that he was an ordinary person with no airs and graces. And I think probably you need to be someone who is extraordinarily grounded and strong, have a and someone who has a very strong sense of self-worth to be able to use humor in that self-deprecatory way. But you know, Lincoln was often telling stories about against himself, particularly in respect of his physiology, you know, his very unusual physical proportions. You know, he was not just a very tall man, but he had these unusually long limbs. And of course, his critics called him the gorilla, the original gorilla. He was considered by many to be an ugly man. And so he took that on board and used it as a means of humor to deflect it. There were many stories. One that's perhaps the most familiar one is when he encountered a stranger in a railroad car who said to him, "Excuse me, sir, but I have an article in my possession which belongs to you." And the guy took a jackknife from his pocket and said, "This was placed in my hand some years ago with the injunction that I was to keep it until I found a man uglier than myself. Allow me to say that I think you are fairly entitled to the property." And there's another occasion when Lincoln was frequently photographed during the Civil War, as we know. Many, perhaps 60 or 70 or 80 different occasions where he sat. And on one of these occasions, the photographer said, "Look, just look natural." To which Lincoln replied, "Well, that's what I'm trying to avoid." So a long answer to your question, but yeah, absolutely central to humor, absolutely central to our full understanding of Lincoln, something that he considered to be central. He himself, when we're able to interview him now, he would agree that his humor was absolutely at the core of what he was, and something that he deployed to great effect, both in private and in public, in the political and legal settings.
One of the things I enjoyed about reading your book was how you use that to get into an examination of political culture during the time, Lincoln on the stuff, and it was very fascinating. But one of the things that I thought was especially interesting was your description of how his use of humor on the stump evolved. And you describe a couple of instances where he realized that as effective and as valuable as humor could be, that he needed to exercise restraint in using it because it could have an effect beyond what...
Indeed. I think he got into trouble as a younger man in his use of humor. And I came to learn, I think, that restraint in the use of humor in public was something that would be to his advantage, to his benefit. Let me give you there is sort of two periods where he thinks about the proper place of humor in public life. The first is when he's now established in the late 30s and the early 1840s as one of the leading political figures in Illinois. He has a reputation by then for the use of wit and storytelling, of use of anecdotes. He's an attractive, engaging public speaker. He's also knows that when he's in any kind of informal gathering of number, but a number of people in an informal setting, his storytelling and his mimicry makes him a very popular figure. So, I mean, one of the reasons he was elected to the captaincy of the military company of the Black Hawk War, the company of New Salemites in the Black Hawk War, was because he was popular figure who had won that popularity through his being a very, very engaging company. So he knows the value of that particular tray in his armory, that particular instrument in his armory. But in the campaign for the legislature in 1840, he responded to a particularly stinging speech of Judge Thomas, Jesse Thomas, And for the first time ever in public, as Billy Herndon tells us, Lincoln resorted to mimicry for effect. And he imitated the peculiarities of Judge Thomas's gesture, his particular voice, and his particular walk, which was, I believe, as I understand it, very imitable. And Thomas broke down and began to blubber like a baby, as it was described. The skinning of Thomas was how the event came to be known. And Lincoln recognized he'd gone too far. In fact, he went and sought out Judge Thomas to make an apology. Lincoln knew that he'd won the debate, but he'd done so at a cost. And that lesson was driven home even more powerfully a couple of years. So there was a parallel lesson a couple of years later, a very painful episode in 1842, when he used satire in the pages of the Sangamon Journal to attack the Democratic state auditor, James Shields. Shields was a vain man. He was an easy target. But this particular attack was, amongst other things, sexually demeaning. And Shields, who had a very short fuse, challenged Lincoln to a duel which Lincoln didn't want to accept, didn't really believe in the ethics of dueling, but he felt he had no option but to accept. Having accepted the duel, he was, as the person who had been challenged, the person who made the selection of weapons, and he chose cavalry broadswords of the largest size. I think there was some dark humor in the selection of weapons there. And at the last moment, fortunately, the seconds managed to avert the duel. But Lincoln was forever ashamed of that particular affair. It dogged him politically. It may well have denied him the nomination for the Whig congressional seat, or the congressional seat as a Whig, when he were hoping to run for Congress in 1842, 1844. It certainly dogged him into the 1850s, and it was a subject that he always really wanted to deflect. So he'd learned through the skinning of Thomas and through the Shields affair that taken to extreme ridicule and humor could be damaging as well as helpful. So when in the mid-1850s, following the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska bill, the Nebraska Act, which of course repealed the Missouri Compromise, opened up the Western territories to the prospect of slavery, and which re-energized Lincoln politically and led him to return to state politics and with an eye on national politics. He, from that point onwards, in 1854 onwards, beginning with the great Springfield and then Peoria speech of that fall. What you see in Lincoln is much more earnestness in his mode of public speaking. It leads his friends to say, particularly during the debates with Douglas in 1858, you know, why aren't you using your usual store of anecdotes and stories and mimicry, this proven and potent weapon from earlier times? Why he wasn't using this against Douglas? And Lincoln replied, well, you know, the occasion is too grave and too serious. We're now having to discuss matters of great moment, and if we bring bring humor into play, if we bring anecdotes into play, then that is a detraction from the seriousness of the issue. So yes, Mark, you're right that there is a shift, a discernible shift in the way in which Lincoln deploys or thinks about humor in the 1850s, from the way in which he deployed it at an earlier stage. And this becomes, I mean, that way of thinking about the place of humor in public life is reinforced by the onset of war. Because although Lincoln, on the one hand, he's the first president consistently to make storytelling and laughter tools of the office in private, in the cabinet, in the company of friends, colleagues, visitors to the White House. That's true, but his public pronouncements and his speeches were almost invariably serious. What he does as president is to use his humor as a means of making military and political points with great economy, and I can give you a few examples of those if you like. Well, just a few, which there are many more in the book, but. One example. Lincoln gets a telegram from General Pope, John Pope, Major General John Pope, that he'd captured 5,000 of Beauregard's men and was now marching on the Confederates and would soon have the Confederates in his power. And the cabinet, knowing of this telegraph, asked the president for his opinion. And Lincoln replied, as he so often did, by saying, "That reminds me of the story." That reminds me of the story is the kind of litany, the incantation that is repeated over and over, not just by Lincoln, but by those who just love in the press to say another story from the president. The president tells the story that reminds him of that. On this occasion, the story was of an old woman in Sangamon County who was ill, and the doctor was called. He prescribed some medicine for her, for her condition, which he diagnosed as constipation. And when he came back the following morning, he found her fresh and getting breakfast. She seemed to be well recovered. Asking her then if the medicine had worked, she said, "Yes, it has." And to which he said, "How many bowel movements?" 142. To which the physician said, "Madam, I'm serious. You have to be joking. How many? I must know." 142. "No," he said, "you couldn't have had 142. It's unnecessary that I have the exact number of movements. I tell you, 142. 140 of them, wind." Well, Lincoln closed the discussion by adding, telling the cabinet, "I'm afraid Pope's captures are 140 of them, wind." There's another example. I'll just give you one more example. This is the Trent affair. During the discussions in December of 1861, you recall Britain had threatened war over the Union Navy's seizure of Confederate envoys from a British ship. In December of 1861, the cabinet is discussing this, and Lincoln finds he's got the support of only one cabinet member. And he recalled the drunk who had strayed into an Illinois church and fallen asleep in the front pew. The drunk slumbered on as the revivalist asked who were on the Lord's side. The congregation responded by rising as one en masse. And then when the preacher inquired, "And who are on the side of the devil?" The sleeper stirred, but not entirely grasping the inquiry, and seeing the minister on his feet, he stood up and said, I don't exactly understand the question, but I'll stand by you, parson, to the last. But it seems to me that we're in a hopeless minority." And again, you know, Lincoln didn't need to say any more than that. He just made his point very powerfully. I mean, but as well as this use of stories as sort of parables, as sort of anecdotes to illustrate a point more powerfully, he also, I think, had a wonderful swiftness of wit, sometimes to deflect political requests. There's a famous tale told, one of my favorite tales told, which appears in Ward Lamon's recollections of of Lincoln and the White House, and it has to do with the delegation who came to urge the appointment of a friend of theirs as commissioner to the Sandwich Islands, Hawaii, of course. And they emphasized not only the man's fitness for the post, but his poor health, which they said would benefit from the balmy climate of the Sandwich Islands. Well, the president closed the interview with affected regret by saying, "Gentlemen, I am sorry to say that there are 8 other applicants for that place, and they're all sicker than your man." And again, you know, he thinks fast on his feet, but he does it with grace and with humor. In a slightly more embarrassing setting, although Lincoln was no drawing room wit, he did have he could be clever in the swiftness of his rejoinders. As I say, particularly when the situation might be socially awkward. And the episode that I have particularly in mind is one where he was engaging in conversation with a young woman in a hospital. The young woman was deeply interested in a soldier, hospitalized soldier who was there in the bed in the hospital, and she was pressing the question on him. Where, she said, "Where were you wounded?" Now, the infantryman who'd been shot through the testicles repeatedly deflected the inquiry by saying, "Ma'am, I was wounded at Antietam." So the young woman then asked the president to assist her, but Lincoln talked privately with the soldier and then took the young woman's hands in his own, explaining, "My dear girl, the ball that hit him would have missed you." I a long answer to your inquiry about the way in which Lincoln moves from being a rather unconstrained satirist and wit and mimic in the 1830s and 1840s into a more serious, someone who uses humor with more constraint, but perhaps with more delicacy, perhaps using the stiletto more than the hatchet, but I think becoming all the more effective by virtue of the restraint that he imposes on himself.
One of the things that you do in this book is you go and look at the sources of his humor. And what you convey is that he had such a range of sources. There were some that you describe as that he favored in detail, some that he really enjoyed. But he really had this very broad set of sources that he could deploy whenever he.
Yes, he himself said that you know, he didn't make up any of his stories. He said he was a retail dealer, and that his great strength was actually having a wonderful memory rather than having a great originating capacity or capacity for originating jokes. I think that's probably true, although as I just given you an example with the conversation with the young woman in the hospital, or the deputation coming looking to get their friend appointed to the Sandwich Islands. He could be fast, very fast and nimble on his feet, but in terms of the range of his humor and the story that he tells, they are mostly gleaned, they're overwhelmingly gleaned from a huge variety of different sources. I mean, some of the stories probably are just, many of them are word of mouth. He grows up in a rural society where storytelling was part of everyday conversation. His uncle, Mordecai, was a great raconteur, and there was no one within the family who was a better storyteller than his own father, Thomas Lincoln. So there's the family, there are friends and acquaintances in the farming community, in politics, in the courtroom, who are not just his audience for storytelling, but also suppliers of comic material that he could use for himself. He read widely. in humorous sources. He loved Byron's poetry, but above all, perhaps the poetry of Robert Burns. Certainly, Byron and Burns are two influences on him. Sidney Smith, the Reverend Sidney Smith, the English essayist, the fellow depressive, in fact, I think when Lincoln. When Lincoln said about one of his cabinet members, and he was probably referring to Chase or Stanton, that it, and I quote, would take a surgical operation to get a joke into his head, Lincoln was using a formulation, a witty formulation of the Reverend Sidney Smith, who is one of, I think, one of the most admirable humorists of the on the British side of the Atlantic in these years. There's Joseph Baldwin's Flush Times and Alabama and Mississippi. This is a comic tale centered on larger-than-life characters. And then during the war years, Lincoln took real delight in the comic writings of three young literary comedians, Charles Farrar Brown, Robert Henry Newell, and in particular David Ross Locke. I mentioned Locke earlier. Brown wrote him in the guise of an itinerant showman, Artemus Ward. Locke in the guise of an ignorant pro-slavery preacher, Petroleum V. Naseby. Noel wrote in the guise of Orpheus C. Kerr. If you say that name quickly, Orpheus C. Kerr, it becomes clear what he's doing. He's writing about a recognizable type of office seeker, political office seeker, who forms a target for ridicule. Lincoln also owned, we know he owned a copy of widely circulating and frequently reprinted 18th century English joke book by Joe Miller, Joe Miller's Jests. There are those who thought that Lincoln had learnt the entire contents of Miller, but had sort of embellished them and changed the stories to his own use, to his own context. I'm sure that's true. The story about Lincoln having learning that Ulysses S. Grant was drinking too much, there were the stories of Grant's drinking of whiskey were legion. And Lincoln's response was to say simply, "Well, he would like to know what brand of whiskey he was drinking, because he'd like to send the crate of whiskey to his other generals." I mean, that's a well known story, but it's not original to Lincoln. It actually goes back to Joe Miller in the 18th century Joe Miller jest book, in the courtroom. There's a case where Lincoln adapted one of Miller's stories to illustrate a particular legal plea. The plea was of son assault de mine, in other words, his own first assault. The defendant, Lincoln told the jury, had been protecting himself against the plaintiff's abuse and violence, and he drew on Miller to liken his client to a man who, when walking along the highway with a pitchfork over his shoulder, was attacked by a savage dog that had come out of a barnyard, and to protect himself, the man who was walking along stuck the prongs of his fork into the beast and killed the dog. "Well, what made you kill my dog?" said the farmer. What made him try to bite me? But why didn't you go at him with the other end of your pitchfork?" "Well, why didn't he come at me with his other end?" And at this point, Lincoln is holding up an imaginary dog in his long arms and kind of whirling it about and pushing its back end towards the faces of the jurors. He made them understand very immediately what the nature of this particular plea, his own first assault, was all about. So Lincoln draws on a whole range of sources. In addition, I think I mention, I know I mention Shakespeare and the Bible as other sources of illustration. He knew Shakespeare. I won't say he knew all of Shakespeare, but he knew some of Shakespeare extremely well, well enough to be able to quote long speeches from memory. Equally, he could draw on passages of the Bible and on quotations from the Bible out of context, in a different context, but to his own benefit. In other words, using both Shakespeare and the Bible was so well known in the context that Lincoln moved in. This is a society where scripture is just the ubiquitous text. But Lincoln's capacity to apply quotations or apply passages of the Bible in unexpected ways, again, was a means of drawing out the humor of the situation.
One of the points you make in the book, and you've already alluded to this, was that Lincoln didn't just use humor to appeal to his audience in as a person or to win them over on an emotional level, but you also describe how he uses humor to make a moral critique that you refer to as laughter, and I love this phrase, as a just laughter. And I was wondering if you could elaborate upon that a bit.
Yes, I said earlier on that I think the humor is the core of Lincoln's being, and it's not just because he finds in humor a event for his moods. It's not just that it's a simple therapy, but I think it also, in some of its dimensions at least, it speaks to his moral sense. I mentioned that what had got me interested in Lincoln's humor more generally and in writing about it more generally was his love of David Ross Locke's creation, Petroleum v. Naseby, this particular satirical text that Lincoln could quote from at great length. The text is there in his own copy of the Naseby sermons is there in the Library of Congress, and if you look at it, you'll see that it's singed from probably by the candlelight by which Lincoln was reading it at night in the White House, and he said to David Ross Locke that for the genius to have written this satire, he would gladly have given up the presidency. This was the remark, of course, of a president who had himself attempted to write satirically in the early 1840s and had got into serious trouble, as I mentioned earlier. So Lincoln is a sort of satirist manqué, a satirist who has tried it and hasn't quite got it. But David Ross Locke does. Petroleum v. Naseby is a pro-slavery preacher. The V in the name stands for Vesuvius, that's sort of a signal for readers of the text to ready themselves for kind of eruptions, caustic eruptions on the pressing issues of the day. Naseby, Petroleum v. Naseby, the pastor of the Church of the New Dispensation, was a selfish, conniving political office seeker, whiskey drinking, greedy, bigoted, unprincipled, racist, hypocritical. I mean, and the character was created by David Ross Locke out of his profound anger over the white supremacism, the pro-slavery theology, and the insincere pacifism of the Peace Democrats, the Copperhead Peace Democrats. David Ross Locke, is based in Findlay, Ohio. He's a New Englander by origin, upstate and then upstate New York, New England origins. In Findlay, he uses the platform of his newspaper to make this satirical assault on the Copperheadism, Lincoln's admiration for Locke has gone largely unexamined, and one has to say why, ask why. Partly, I think it's because for a modern audience, the Copperhead theology of Naseby makes it very alien, makes it less accessible to modern readers, although I think, frankly, it's much more accessible than at first sight it appears. It's also because Naseby is just a horrendously offensive racist, and the language that Locke uses to portray, to use in the satirical portrayal, in the satirical portrayal, that language understandably touches a very raw nerve today. There's no softening of the vulgar here in deference to sort of modern taste. So I think there are reasons why Naseby has gone unexamined and perhaps therefore underappreciated. But Lincoln's love of this text, I think, tells you something about the moral dimensions of Lincoln's own humor. He knew exactly what it was these Copperhead Democrats were drawing on, the kind of attitudes they were drawing on. He had no time for the ideology that sustained African American enslavement. As you say, those attitudes challenge Lincoln's own profound sense of justice. One of my favorite texts of Lincoln, one of my favorite documents, Lincoln for the in the 1850s, is just a fragment that we have in which he shows his scorn for the Presbyterian pro-slavery theologian Frederick Ross, the minister Frederick A. Ross, who had written a text on defending slavery through the use of scripture. I have that actually in front of me here as I talk. That the fragment says in his assault on Ross, Lincoln says that Ross has concluded that it is better for some people to be slaves, and in such cases it is the will of God that they be such. Well, Lincoln says the fact that determining God's will was to be left to Dr. Ross, who, and I quote, sits in the shade with gloves on his hands and subsists on the bread that Sambo is earning in the burning sun, gave little confidence that he would be actuated by that perfect impartiality which has ever been considered most favorable to correct decisions. I think that's a magnificently dry, I mean, there's humor in that, but it's an edge, it's humor with an edge. It's a dry wit that Lincoln is using there in his dismissing of pro-slavery theology. Leonard Swett, one of Lincoln's closest colleagues, both before and indeed during the war, Swett maintained that Lincoln read Naseby as much as he did the Bible. And I think it's not widely known that on the last afternoon of Lincoln's life, he delayed dinner by reading Naseby aloud to two old friends from Illinois. This was the afternoon before he later went off to Ford's Theatre to watch the Victorian comedy Our American Cousin, a frivolous comedy. I think we do much better to remember Lincoln by his repudiation of the ethical world of Petroleum V. Naseby than we do by his going to watch Our American Cousin, because it was Naseby that gave Lincoln so much more pleasure than did the frivolity of that play that he was watching when he was shot by John Wilkes Booth. So, the answer to your question, I think Lincoln's strong sense of justice leads him to an appreciation of satire that is written with an equally powerful sense of the injustice of those who sustain slavery by a pro-slavery theology, and the injustice of those peace Democrats who purport to be principled pacifists, but who are really seeking to sustain slavery and the, by extension, the efforts of the Confederates to undermine the Union. So Lincoln's humor, in an appreciation of humor in this particular respect, I think has to be seen as very much part of his ethical makeup.
You describe in the book just how much humor shaped Lincoln's image for his contemporaries. And I thought it was especially interesting how, as you were talking about earlier, he used it on the stump, he used it in court, and it became part of what people identified about him. And yet, as you described as well, he is in the situation where he's in this war, and yet people were oftentimes turning to him, hoping that he would provide them relief, not just in terms of victory, but in terms of a diversion by telling them a joke or telling them a story.
Yes. And of course, this cuts both ways. It has its benefits, and it also has its profound disadvantages. There's no doubt at all that many people warmed to Lincoln, many of his supporters and many Republicans and many on the side of the Union warmed to the president as a man who, bone-weary and suffering in the White House, found relief in jokes and jests, that this was a measure of his humanity, and that his telling of stories was a measure not just of his suffering, but also of his geniality, of being a person that they could find attractive, that they could warm to, they could identify with, and undoubtedly, those who spoke for the administration and who spoke for the president were happy to cultivate that picture. So Lincoln's personal private secretary, one of them, John Hay, had cultivated a warm relationship with several journalists and went on supplying them with examples of the president's wit, so that this was one of the reasons why there so often appeared in the press another example of Lincoln's stories, a story, this reminds me of the story that, and then the story follows. It's undoubtedly the case that many could warm to Lincoln because of his being one of them, being a man who could share a common tale and who had the common touch. Yes. That's right. In fact, some of these stories are preposterous. I mean, some of these jokes are not very funny, and mostly they are compilations of stories that have been around for some time. But they just, because Lincoln has this reputation of being a man who loves a story and loves a joke, they simply attach his name to the title of the book. So it's Old Abe's Joke Book. They bear no real relationship to what he himself was laughing at, or what the stories that he himself was telling. But there is a commercial you're quite right, yes, there's a commercial advantage to be made out of associating Lincoln's name with jest books and joke books during the war. But of course, as I say, there's another side to it, which is that many of Lincoln's stories, he would himself have said most of them were pretty vulgar, pretty earthy, pretty off color. When he was asked why he didn't publish his stories, he said, he apparently made a face and said, "Oh, couldn't possibly do that." He said, "They would stink. These stories would stink like a thousand privies. They were noxious and only really intended for private telling, and by implication, the private telling amongst males." I suspect that, in fact, I have good reason to believe that these supposedly immodest stories were, I think, more offensive to the Victorian sensibilities than to our own. I'll give you one example, and it's probably an adaptation of one of the many stories in the jest books I've mentioned. But there's the story of a collector of relics who loves old things, and he hears about an old lady with a dress that she'd worn during the Revolutionary War. So he visits her and asks if she'd produce the dress just to satisfy this love that he has of things that are antique. So she produces her dress, and he seizes it and enthusiastically holds it up, saying, "Were you the dress that this lady, once young and blooming, wore in the time of Washington? No doubt when she came home from the dressmaker, she kissed you as I do now." And as he did just that, heartily kissing the dress, the old lady, the owner, remarked, "Stranger, if you want to kiss something old, you'd better kiss my ass. It's 16 years older than that dress." It's not the funniest of stories, but it's a nice story. I don't think it would raise many concerns if it were told by a modern politician. But this was the kind of story that Lincoln didn't want to get out. But it is the case that his enemies could deploy or could use his reputation for the teller of the supposed low jokes or smutty stories as a stick with which to beat him. They could say, "What does this do? This shows that the president lacks the gravitas required of a president. That he's having to resort to humor to make up for his deficiencies in command." And it also showed that Lincoln had a cruel disregard for the suffering victims of the war. And in 1864, in particular, in the campaign of 1864, this charge of Lincoln, the smutty joker, appears regularly, routinely, and in a way and to an extent that is unprecedented. One of the advantages of these search engines that we now have with digitized newspapers is you can track the use of the expression "the smutty joker" and Lincoln, the appearance of Lincoln jokes and reputation and the reputation that he has on both sides, both as a genial joke teller and as a smutty joker. You can track that, and it's quite clear that in the election of 1864, this now reaches new levels of criticism on the part of the Democrats, and Lincoln. The widowmaker, who is has spent more time in telling obscene jokes than he does in thinking about the cruelties and the horrors of the battlefield, and this reaches its particular incarnation in one bogus accusation that was repeated over and over, that when Lincoln had been touring the Antietam battlefield in October of 1862, at a time when the Union corpses were being buried, that Lincoln had shockingly turned to Hill Lamon, to Marshal Lamon, and had asked Lamon to sing a Negro song, the song in particular, "Picayune Butler's Coming to Town." It was a popular African-American banjo song performed by blackface minstrels. The truth of the story was, in fact, that the truth of the story was that it didn't happen like that. What had happened was that some weeks after the After the battle, when there were no bodies on the battlefield, Lincoln had indeed been traveling over the ground in an ambulance with Ward Lamon, Hill Lamon, and with George McClellan. But he had not asked Lamon to sing this particular song. Lincoln thought this charge appeared over and over again through the campaign of 1864, and Lincoln thought seriously about publicly repudiating it, and did wrote out a repudiation which he thought might appear over Lamon's own name, but eventually decided that actually it was better not to rise to the to the bait, that this would do, would be unlikely to change any views, and would simply bring him down to the level of those who were making the charge. But it's interesting that in 1864, both before and after the fall of Atlanta, which of course was the signal watershed moment of the campaign, but both before and after that, this charge of Lincoln the smutty joker is persistently leveled at the president as he sought re-election.
It's just fascinating to consider how that reputation was so prominent, and how within a matter of a couple of generations, it has been, you know, it was totally forgotten as we sort of replaced it with a much more austere and grave image of him.
You're absolutely right, Mark. I find when I'm on this side of the Atlantic, I'm speaking now to you from my home in England. On this side of the Atlantic, when I tell people that I just published a book on Lincoln's sense of humor, they almost routinely say, "Oh, well, that's that must be a very short book." I have no sense that Lincoln had any humor at all. I think that's partly because of the that great model statue in Washington, and partly because the engraved words in the Lincoln Memorial are a measure of the seriousness of the purposes that he pursued and his capacity for magnificent prose, prose that is powerful, is ethical, but is not in the least bit humorous. While I think that Americans do have more of a sense that Lincoln was a man who had the capacity for wit, and whose sayings have come down, some of them, of course, not his own, but apparently some of his sayings have come down to us. Even in the United States, I think the full reality of Lincoln's humor is not fully appreciated, and that's understandable. It's also, I think, the case that when you start looking at Lincoln's stories and jokes, they are of their time. They have to be understood in the context in which the stories were told and the wit was made manifest. I think it's quite interesting how well a lot of that humor has survived. It's of its time, but in some respects, I wouldn't say it's timeless, but it has traveled. It has traveled into the 21st century and can still be appreciated. But what matters for us when we look at Lincoln above all is Lincoln the reconstructor of the Union, Lincoln the emancipator, Lincoln the man whose moral compass is I think much more evident in what we read about him than his humorous compass. But I would argue that actually his humor and his capacity for humor, his capacity for seeing the absurdities of life, capacity for appreciating human foibles, was very much part of that larger ethical understanding of the world. I'm second to none in admiring Lincoln's application of a moral dimension, or his bringing of a moral dimension to the politics of the 1850s and of the Civil War itself. But I think we do him a disservice if we don't see that that moral perspective was itself shaped in part by his what I call his sense of humor.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I'm returning to a project that I began in 2004, the year when I won the Lincoln Prize, and the project was shelved. Lincoln took over my life. I'm not at all unhappy about that. But the project was a project that related to some lectures that I was giving, I'd been invited to give at Cambridge University, at Cambridge, England, that is. And the lectures are on the place of religion in the construction of the American nation from the Revolution through to Reconstruction. It's a big subject, and not exactly a novel subject, but I think I'm hoping I can bring something fresh to the topic. I call it Building a Righteous Nation, and I look at the different and competing ways in which Americans thought about righteousness. Righteousness not simply in terms of their church going and in their religious lives, but how they brought that into the political arena. So it grows naturally, I think, out of the work that I've done on Lincoln in the over the last 20 years, but also goes back to work that I much of my career has been in my academic scholarship, as it were, has been in the area of American religion. And it'll be a way, really, of bringing together the themes that I pursued in understanding Lincoln and the themes that preceded that when I was working on, particularly on evangelicals in the era leading up to the Civil War.
Well, I'm sorry you're turning away from Lincoln, but it sounds like it's going to be a fascinating book.
Well, I hope so. and in retirement, semi-retirement, I hope have the space and time to pursue that. I'm certainly looking forward to getting my teeth into it. I think it's a subject that speaks to my interest, but I think also is a subject that's in its own right is a big one and an important one, and one that I hope will shed some further light on the way in which the nation made its way to the crux of its history, the American Civil War.
Richard, thanks for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much, Mark. I've enjoyed it very much indeed. Thank you.